dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. Here at home, that war has been fought in rather unconventional ways of late, notably in the courts by very, very strenuous opponents of President Trump and specifically his efforts to try to restrict the immigration to this country of people who may wish to do us harm. This has been the subject of a very, very important decision by the Supreme Court just yesterday. And to discuss that and more with us, I couldn't be more pleased to say we are joined by Hans von Spakovsky of the Heritage Foundation. He is a senior legal fellow there in the Edwin Meese Center for Legal and Judicial Studies. Hans, it's so good to have you back. Thank you very much for taking a few minutes.
Well, Frank, it's always great to talk to you.
I'm interested in your thoughts. There's a lot of disagreement about what exactly the Supremes did yesterday in the ruling that they handed down on the so-called travel ban. Of course, it's actually an immigration pause. Where do you come down on all these questions, Hans?
Oh, I think it was a big, big victory for the president, and that I'm sure that's what's making a lot of opponents of his angry. Look, in essence, what the court did is they said, we are lifting the injunction that is preventing the enforcement of the president's order that temporarily halted entry from the six terrorist safe havens in Africa and the Middle East. And what they said was that this law, this order can be enforced against any foreign aliens who basically have no connection with the U.S. So if you're a Somali native and you want to get a visa to come to the U.S., they don't even have to let you start to apply for the visa process because, as you know, there's a 90-day suspension of that. Now, the court did allow to remain in place the part of the injunction that would prevent any foreign alien who has a credible, bona fide relationship with someone or an entity in the U.S. Some may see that as a big loss for the president, but actually it just kind of confirms what the government was already doing. If you look at the original order, Frank, it basically set up what they called a waiver system. So any alien who wanted to get a visa and get waived from that 90-day suspension had the ability to do it on a case-by-case basis. And look, you and I both know what would cause a customs enforcement or State Department person to waive the requirement? Well, it's going to be some kind of family connection, something like that. So in essence, even though that part of the injunction is still in place, I don't think it really changes what the government was already doing.
Let me drill down on that, though, with you for a moment. Andy McCarthy, your friend and mine, has written on this ruling, and I am generally very much persuaded by what he says. And he's warned that what the Supremes have done in this case is create essentially a new right to come to this country on the part of people who can establish some such connection, a bona fide relationship, as the court said. Should we be concerned about that?
Oh, look, I agree with him. I mean, I'll be the first to tell you that I agree with the partial dissent that was written by the three terrific conservative justices on the court, Thomas, Alito, and Gorsuch. And they basically said, well, we're agreeing with what the court's doing, but we actually think the entire injunction should be lifted. And I agree with Andy. I think they are potentially creating this right for people from outside to be in the U.S., and I think that goes against prior precedents of the court. But remember, they're not making a decision on the merits of the case right now. That's not going to happen until October. So, you know, they decided that most of the injunction will get lifted. We'll leave this small part of it in place. Hopefully, in October, when they hear the substantive merits, they will not make that a permanent rule.
And Hans, do you anticipate that, as some seem to, including it sounded like some of the justices, they hope this whole thing is going to be mooted by the executive order's duration by its own terms having expired come October or November. Is that likely to be the case, and therefore we won't get a ruling on the merits?
Frank, that depends entirely on what they find when they do their internal review. Because remember, the whole point of this executive order suspending temporarily entry was to make sure that we've got the right kind of vetting procedures in place to thoroughly check the backgrounds of anybody trying to come in from this country. You know, it's going to be if they come back and they say we got all the procedures in place now, we can go back to normal visa processing procedures. Well, then, yeah, the case is kind of mooted. But look, if they come back and say there is no way to vet people coming in from Somalia or Sudan or Iran, and we recommend to the president that we basically have a long-term ban on entry from those countries, well, then it will still be a very big decision that the court has to make as the president acting within his authority.
Hans, let me, in the brief time we have left, turn to another of your areas of expertise, and that is on election law and practice. You served for 2 years as a member of the Federal Elections Commission. You co-authored with John Fund, Who's Counting? How Fraudsters and Bureaucrats Put Your Vote at Risk. Talk, if you would, a little bit, Hans, about the latest on that front. The court apparently is going to be ruling on a case out of Wisconsin that may touch on broader application of voter ID laws, as I understand it, or
which,
on redistricting, right?
Yeah, which, as you know, is, look, the main thing that helps determine how many state legislators we have from various political parties in the states and how many members of Congress we have from the various political parties in Congress, all that depends greatly on redistricting when they draw the lines. And what the Supreme Court said just a week or so ago is that they were going to take up a case in their new term, which starts in the fall, a case out of Wisconsin called Gill versus Whitford. And the reason this is an important case is, look, for years the Supreme Court has said that state legislatures can pretty much, you know, do redistricting according to whatever state criteria is, with the exception that they can't race can't be the predominant factor in your redistricting. If you do that, you're violating the Voting Rights Act. They also have said you've got to make your populations as equal as possible. You know, you can't have districts with 50,000 people in one and 100,000 in another. They've got to pretty much be as equal as possible. But what they have stayed away from is claims of partisan redistricting. And that's what the Wisconsin case is all about. The lower courts in Wisconsin tossed out the statewide legislative redistricting plan for the state legislature, saying that the Republicans there had engaged in an unconstitutional partisan gerrymander because they hadn't produced enough seats for Democrats. Hopefully the court, it took up the case to basically reverse this lower decision, because I can't think of anything worse and a greater violation of separation of powers than to have courts deciding how much politics is okay when you're doing redistricting. That is not something they should be doing. That is entirely up to the legislative branch, not the court.
This is an issue that Daniel Horowitz, again, our mutual friend, has been warning of for some time in terms of judicial overreach. And again, I know you'll be keeping track of this, and we look forward to talking with you about it. I did want to close by just saying I understand that Rush Limbaugh is expressing concern about the subject of your book, Obama's Enforcer, Eric Holder's Justice Department, that he suggests that Eric Holder may have an ambition to run for president in 2020. Are you hearing anything to that effect?
Well, that has been the rumor circulating around Washington for the past week. I can't think of anything quite worse than having Eric Holder run. He politicized the Justice Department to an extent never seen before in its history, and he is the biggest pusher of racial identity politics around. I mean, he would just be terrible for the country.
Hans, thank you very much for taking some time to parse these important developments on the judicial front with us. I look forward to visiting with you again in the near future. Hans von Spakovsky from the Heritage Foundation. Keep up the good work, my friend. Come back to us again very soon. Next up, Richard Pollack joins us from the Daily Caller News Foundation. We'll talk about Hillary's emails, the latest on that scandal, and perhaps a new one involving John McCain. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It is a great privilege and pleasure to have with us once again, a friend and colleague of many years, Richard Pollack. He is these days the senior investigative reporter for the Daily Caller News Foundation. He has worked in various journalistic positions over many years, however, including as the bureau chief for PJ Media in Washington, also a Washington producer for Good Morning America and a senior producer for Fox News Sunday. He is a man whose particular, I think, contribution to the cause at the moment involves trying to help the rest of us keep track of and make sense of what is going on inside the Beltway, and in particular in that space between government and the law and national security. Nobody does it better than Richard Pollack, and it's great to have him with us. Richard, welcome. Thanks for taking a few minutes to talk with us.
Thank you.
I'd like to start, I think, with some reporting you've been doing recently about the current and ongoing probe of what Hillary Clinton did that may have compromised national security in the so-called email scandal she has been implicated in now. What's the latest on that? There's talk, I understand, from your reporting of her clearances being pulled. Is that the case?
Well, apparently the State Department has undertaken an inquiry, a formal inquiry, as to whether or not Hillary Clinton and her top aides should have their security clearances stripped from them. A lot of people don't realize that after you leave government in the national security area, especially at a very high level, you usually retain those security clearances because people need to talk to you about projects or issues that they were working on while they were in office. Also, sometimes they're asked to go on boards, or if there's an emergency, they bring them on board, and they don't want them to be bereft of a security clearance. In this case, it appears that the State Department has decided to link the private server that she held, in which she transmitted classified and highly sensitive documents on this private server that was in her home in Chautauqua, New York. And they are looking at whether or not to eliminate or strip her of her security clearances, along with Huma Abedin, Cheryl Mills, and Jake Sullivan. And this is a very serious inquiry.
This comes against the backdrop, of course, of this ongoing question of how rigorously were these issues addressed during the Obama administration. It appears as though Jim Comey, the then director of the FBI, and his deputy, Andrew McCabe, both seemed to have sort of taken a dive on all of this. Chris Farrell of Judicial Watch has described such behavior as that of dirty cops. Is that your view as well?
Well, I think that all of Washington was really shocked when on July 5th of last year, Director Comey at the FBI exonerated essentially Hillary Clinton for the use of her server, again, for transmitting highly classified material, including the special access program, the nation's highest classification. And an awful lot of people felt that there was no, he was playing the role essentially of a prosecutor, not an investigator, because he said no prosecutor would charge her, which is not his role. And he went on to say merely that she was careless with her handling of these documents, which I think is probably the most charitable way to describe what she was doing. Remember,
I think he actually said extremely careless, but even that seems to understate the problem.
Oh, yes, extremely careless. I am so sorry. But still, let me tell you that I spoke to an awful lot of people in the intelligence community that if they were to have done what Hillary did, they either would have not only been stripped of their rank and punished, they might even see the inside of a prison cell. This is the double standard here between what other people face in the intelligence community. Let me just tell you one very quick story. A friend of mine who was at the NSC went to Israel for his son's bar mitzvah, and he was in the intelligence community. He did not tell them he was going to Israel. This was one of the reasons why he lost his security clearance, because he did not inform them about a social outing to Israel. So you can just imagine, compare that to what Hillary did with her. She turned over 55,000 pages, and that's only half of the amount of emails that were on her server. So I'm very encouraged that there's at least going to be an inquiry as to whether or not she should retain her security clearance.
Yeah, it seems the very least that can be done. Let me ask you to switch gears, if you would, Richard Pollack. You've also been doing some very important reporting on the Clinton Foundation and some of its misconduct, again, to be very charitable. You've also pointed out of late some rather striking similarities between that foundation and one that has been established by the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, John McCain, a man I've known for 40-odd years. What is going on with John McCain's foundation, and are there reasons to be concerned about perhaps conflicts of interest that it may have incurred as well?
Yes, of course, John McCain is the war hero who came back. He was considered one time a maverick within the Republican Party. However, in 2012, he decided to take his unused presidential fund in his unsuccessful campaign for president in 2008, and he decided to hand over almost $9 million to start up an organization called the McCain Institute for International Leadership. And it not only has his name on it, which is troubling in and of itself, because I think that if people were going to give money to the Richard Pollack Foundation, I don't think I'd give very much, but if it has the name McCain, I suspect that it would attract an awful lot of donations. And the second thing he did was he created a thing called the Sedona Forum, which is once a year a very high-level, completely private and intimate meetings with global leaders, CEOs, political activists, et cetera, in Sedona, Arizona, where the senator is from. And so there are a number of different troubling problems with this. The first is that this Sedona Forum really has great resemblance to the Clinton Global Initiative that Bill Clinton created, and that's when all these world leaders and political activists and CEOs met in New York. And this is where pay-to-play began. And there's an awful lot of concern that as chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, it appears highly inappropriate that you should have a foundation that brings together all of the special interests and which you can go and meet with these different folks. There are also some disclosure issues here. He has refused to disclose, or I should say the McCain Institute and the Arizona State University Foundation, where the institute is housed, they refuse to disclose how much money their big-ticket donors have given. And we're talking about 37 different donors, and they include nine foreign governments, foreign principals, or overseas corporations. It's really, I think, unbecoming the senator that essentially we do not have the kind of openness and transparency that he himself has called for in money and politics in terms of the election. And your audience probably will recall that the campaign finance law that requires even a $250 donation to be publicized, part of the public record, that law is called the McCain-Feingold Law. So he was very tough on openness and transparency with respect to that. But when it comes to this institution, it is very opaque.
Richard Pollack, you do terrific work at the Daily Caller News Foundation. I know you'll keep it up, and I look forward to having you come back to visit with us again very soon.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It's time for our regular weekly visit with our senior fellow with responsibility for the economic warfare portfolio at the Center for Security Policy. He is, of course, Kevin Freeman. He is, among other things, a best-selling author of two books, Secret Weapon and Game Plan, How to Protect Yourself from the Coming Cyber Economic Attack. Kevin Freeman is a chartered financial analyst by training, and you can find his collected works at globaleconomicwarfare.com. I'm very pleased to say he will be shortly the star of his own television program at the Blaze Network entitled Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. Kevin, it's so good to have you back. Welcome.
Thank you, Frank.
I don't know where to begin, Kevin. There's a lot that's taking place in the Middle East, and I'm particularly keen to have your help in making sense of it. We have, of course, of late, a concerted effort by some of the Gulf states, led by Saudi Arabia, to bring one of their own to heel, namely the state of Qatar. And you have Donald Trump supporting the Saudis in doing that, rather explicitly, at the same time as his Secretary of Defense and Secretary of State seem to be backing the Qataris. You have the Qataris getting embroiled in some very interesting and potentially quite telling examples of anti-Western behavior that ought, if anything, it seems to me, shore up the president's position on what the Qataris have been doing. So give us sort of an overall view of what's going on here, and then we'll drill down on some of the latest evidence of Qatari misconduct.
Well, if you look at it from the American viewpoint, the president went to the Middle East. He did his tour. He said, drive them out, referencing the radical Islamists, the terrorists, and so forth. And the Saudis and the Egyptians and Bahrain and others looked and said, well, the problems are nesting in Qatar with ties to Turkey and Iran. And Qatar's where you guys, you have to make a choice. Are you on our side or their side? And they put a list of demands out, and they seem to be holding very strongly to them, which, from my perspective, they need to be driven out. The Muslim Brotherhood is headquartered there for quite some time, and there are a lot of other Islamists and bad activity that we've seen through the years flowing through Qatar.
Yeah. One of those that you have written about in your superb book, Secret Weapon, How Economic Terrorism Brought Down the U.S. Stock Market and Why It Can Happen Again, is evidence that the Qataris may have been involved in a naked short-selling bear raid on Lehman Brothers starting on September 11th, 2008. Talk about the latest evidence that suggests that's exactly what happened, Kevin Freeman, and remind us of the consequences.
Well, the Qatar is tied to all of the financial disasters that happened starting in late 2007 through early 2009, including the stock market crash, including the failure of Lehman Brothers. For example, and the one that's coming out into the press now, Barclays Bank, which is a UK-based bank, is the only bank in the United Kingdom or the United States that did not accept their own government's funding and control. Instead, they structured a deal with Qatar that allowed them to remain independent, and thus a lot of their records remain in the dark. The
independent of their own government, that is, not
yes.
The Qatari government, needless to say.
Oh, no, complete. Yes, exactly. The Qatari government took controlling position, which is just amazing. And how they did it is even more amazing. Barclays, to keep their capital position, it appears, and the Serious Fraud Office in the UK is looking at it, it appears they loaned Qatar some money, which they would be a AAA credit rating borrower, and that adds to the value of their capital, and then the Qataris then return the money in the form of investment. So Barclays really didn't take any outside money. It was their own money they loaned to someone else who then took an equity stake. Well, that's complete. If that's what happened, that is serious fraud, which hence the Serious Fraud Office is investigating. But that let them continue down the path of what I believe is a potential massive bear raid on Lehman Brothers that may have come from the Qatari Investment Fund. It's so hard to tell because of the dark pools and all the things that the big sovereign wealth funds operate. The best we can tell is it emanated out of the Middle East, out of Qatar, that was attacking Lehman Brothers, and then they asked Barclays Bank, why don't you buy Lehman Brothers and rescue them, just like Bank of America bought Merrill Lynch here in the United States? And the answer that they gave was no, but the answer came from the Qataris, not from Barclays, not from the British government, not from the American government, and the entire financial system started to fail when Lehman Brothers went bankrupt and was not rescued.
Yeah. Now, remind us, Kevin, of the role that would have been played in all likelihood in such a scheme by a fellow by the name of Youssef Al-Qaradawi. Who is he and what kind of agenda does he operate on?
Well, in this particular instance, he was the Sharia scholar of the Qatari Sovereign Wealth Fund, but more importantly, he is the senior most Muslim brother and has a television program on Al Jazeera that, you know, he's denounced America, denounced Israel. He is really a bad guy, and he called for the destruction of the Western financial system and capitalism. He's called for a lot of things, and the Muslim Brothers throughout the world go make them happen.
Kevin, speaking of efforts to do harm to Western governments, Western systems, including our capitalist system, could you comment on this report that there seems to have been an attack, a cyber attack on the British Parliament, and what may have flowed from it?
Well, it appears to be a very serious cyber attack. The attack that went into many of the offices there, and it appears to be traced back to Russia. And interestingly enough, there are reports today in Reuters that Russia's oil company Rosneft and others banks in Russia have also suffered attack. And so one might wonder, is this a, you know, an attack with a retaliation, or is this one very bad actor or a number of very bad actors? The point is that there is no location that is going unscathed. Everyone is under attack, and I think that this is part of the, you know, chaos creation desire of some really bad actors.
Yeah. Speaking of which, Kevin, there was a letter signed out by a number of Democratic U.S. senators last week to President Trump, taking him very much to task for a problem that I must say I've been very concerned about, as have you. In fact, it is very much part of your book, Game Plan, How to Protect Yourself from the Coming Cyber Economic Attack, namely the possibility that our very vulnerable electric grid might be subjected to a cyber strike by the Russians or perhaps the Chinese or even the North Koreans or Iranians. The Democratic senators were concerned that the president isn't doing enough on that score. Should we all be concerned that not enough is being done to protect our grid against cyber and, for that matter, other forms of attack?
Well, absolutely. And I welcome the Democrats to the party who looked down on this issue when President Obama was in office and looked down on Russia as a threat when President Obama was in office. Welcome. We're so glad that you've woken up to the reality here. I suspect that they're doing this with a political agenda. I also suspect that the president and his team are working more on the effort than they know. But I am somewhat cynical to the idea that they're just now, I think they're just trying to tie Russia again to the president. But it is a serious threat. It is a nation-ending threat, whether through cyber attack, physical attack, or EMP. If our power grid goes down, America goes down.
Kevin, your clarion calls on these and so many other issues are really appreciated. I hope you'll check out Kevin Freeman's work at globaleconomicwarfare.com and look for him at Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman on the Blaze Network this summer. Kevin, thanks so much for your time today, as always, and for your great work. Keep it up. We'll talk with you very soon. Next up, we will be speaking with George Raceley of Conservative HQ, among other things, the recent court decision on the travel pause and the allocation of sizable amounts of taxpayer money to potential jihadists in America. What is up with that? That more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. Our guest is George Raceley. He is the managing editor of a terrific publication, Richard Viguerie's Conservative HQ. He's always a welcome guest here. George, so good to have you. Thanks for taking a few minutes.
Thank you, Frank, for having me.
I'm interested in your thoughts. We were talking earlier in the program with Hans von Spakovsky about the ruling handed down yesterday by the Supremes in connection with the so-called travel ban. An immigration pause by a more accurate rendering. What are your thoughts on what the Supremes did and whether it is, in fact, as Hans seems to believe, a big win for President Trump?
Well, I agree with Hans. It's a great win for the president. In reading through the ruling, there's a lot of confirmation for his positions on presidential authority regarding immigration and refugees.
Which were very much under assault from the lower courts, let's be clear.
Yeah, absolutely. And particularly the Ninth and Fourth Circuits were, you know, prepared to usurp the presidential and congressional authority and essentially put liberal federal judges in charge of immigration. There was a little bit of a concern I had that there are hints, anyhow, that some of the judges who were in that per curiam decision from the Supreme Court were inclined to make a chain migration sort of a right, which I think is a concern, and we'll have to see when and if this matter goes before the court for argument in the fall, whether that comes up or not. But there were certainly some hints that they were prepared to see some foreigners as having some kind of a unrecognized in legislation or the Constitution, shall we say, right to enter the United States.
This worries me greatly, I must say, and I think it's troubling because it sounds to me, George, as though it's not limited to chain migration as we've historically known it. You know, a family member gets to bring in family members, even extended family members in some cases. But in this instance, it sounds as though what the court was contemplating is though anyone who has a bona fide relationship with persons or institutions in the United States. And the real concern, I guess, is that it would seem as though this is an open invitation to litigate whether your relationship is sufficiently bona fide, shall we say, to justify getting entered.
Yeah, that's certainly one broad interpretation of what the court said, and I think that is a great concern. It was, of course, a fairly broad decision, and it didn't give a lot of detail as to what is defined by that connection, shall we say. And so it certainly would give some hope to those universities and states that purported to represent foreigners who were being unfairly or illegally excluded.
This will be a subject of close watching for all of us, I think, George Raceley. Let me ask you, too. Again, I spoke of Andy McCarthy, one of my gurus on this subject, with Hans a moment ago. He was also expressing the concern, which I share, that the Trump administration may take away from all of this thrashing, that it should not persist in what the president talked about as a candidate. As you recall, when he described the need to keep out people who don't share our values, and specifically made reference to people who are Sharia adherents, Sharia supremacists, if you will. George, do you think that's over the side now as a result of all of this to-ing and fro-ing?
I'm a little more optimistic about that, I guess. I mean, I didn't see anything in the ruling that should dissuade the president from carrying out his responsibilities to defend the country from anti-constitutional forces. And again, there's going to be a lot of argument about the details of some of these definitions, if you will, in the court's ruling. And that's just going to have to be seen in the fall.
George Mason, let me turn to another topic that you've addressed recently, really sort of very much on that same line, namely the decision of the Department of Homeland Security recently to allocate millions of dollars to those involved, or putatively, shall we say, involved in countering violent extremism. And you specifically focused on one very controversial outfit called Majid Muhammad, which garnered a $500,000 grant from the department. What's up with that, and what are these grants expected to do?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, this is a leftover from the Obama administration's failed countering violent extremism program. And what these grants are supposed to do is dissuade Americans from becoming terrorists. But there really are no metrics in this. And in fact, when you look at, polls of Muslims in specific, their inclinations to see America as being anti-Muslim and thus a appropriate object of terrorism have actually grown over the course of Obama's term in office. So there's no indication whatsoever that these grants are actually producing any positive results. And in fact, they're going to organizations such as this mosque in Atlantic City, New Jersey, that are teaching a fairly Salafist-oriented version of Islam, which is certainly anti-constitutional and a source of inspiration for many of the terrorist acts that have occurred in this country.
Do you anticipate that there will be a monitoring of this project by the Majid Muhammad that will ensure that this isn't simply underwriting essentially people who are part of the problem?
Well, that's a very good point. And there is no indication, or as far as I can tell, any monitoring or any metrics applied to this. And that's one of the reasons why I wrote the article. And frankly, money's fungible. I mean, this $500,000 frees up resources that will be used to promote Islam in the Atlantic City area, outside of whatever the CVE program, again, very undefined, that the Masjid Muhammad is going to engage in. And
it's not just Islam, it's specifically Sharia, I'm afraid.
Well, and candidly, the Trump administration really needs to take a hard look at this whole thing. And it is very concerning to me that they couldn't even do a basic Google search of this organization to turn up the stuff that was in my article. And that kind of begs the question, what does extreme vetting of immigrants and refugees look like if they can't even extremely vet their own grantees for $500,000?
It's presumably a product, in part at least, of the Obama holdovers who are still populating the Department of Homeland Security, among other agencies of the United States government. George, you know how important that is. Personnel is politics, is or policy, as has been often said. We have to leave it at that, though, for the moment. Thank you so much for your time today and for the great work you do at Conservative HQ. George Raisley, come back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.